This notion of karma, the way we often speak of it, it has a very logical and rational feeling about it because we use words like cause and effect, or we say for every action, and this is in fact the definition of karma, that for every action there will be an equal and opposite reaction. And it just so appeals to our logical minds. I mean, after all, it is a scientific truth. Of course, it existed long before the scientists were able to prove it. But nonetheless, we've been hearing these things for so long. And I realized this morning the words themselves are so solid. They have a lot of consonants in them. And I think that makes us sort of grab onto them. But the truth is, the notion of karma is so subtle. As Master said in the reading, it's not as if it represents just one thread that's flowing. You did this in that lifetime, so now you'll get this, and you did that. It's so much more complex and really subtle than that, that Master himself says it takes a master. It takes a very great saint to understand the complexity of how this works. I was reading last night, and I read one of the Patanjali Sutras that says, as soon as any desire is satisfied, there follows immediately a fear of its loss. And he says in that sutra, therefore, the mind sets up ever new cravings, he says. We're used to hearing about ever new joy. This is ever new cravings in the mind because one thing gets satisfied and we just both fear its loss, and we also know we then often feel that we need just a little more. And it reminded me when I read that, because I have worked in the field of addiction medicine for many years, as many of you know, so when I read about ever new cravings, which is really what it is that just tortures the addict, this is exactly what happened. And it came to me, what a wonderful example of how karma works. The whole area of addiction is, I'm not going to teach you too much about neurophysiology, but there are receptors in our body called mu receptors. And those receptors are where opiates grab onto when we take them. And as soon as they've bonded to the mu receptor, then pain is resolved, or the perception of pain is changed and lessened. But unfortunately, there's a trick to that, because as you take more and more opiates, the very instant that any mu receptor is exposed, the body thinks it's in pain because it wants more opiates now. And so you begin this cycle of, I need more, I need more, I need more, until soon, and this is all true, this is a simplified telling of a complex but true science now, the person themselves can no longer tell the difference between pain, physical pain that they were having, and this perceived pain, because a couple of mu receptors are exposed and it just simply wants more. Which is just a perfect analogy, really, for what happens for us in life and how we create a lot of karma and how we live in terms of our desires and our likes and our dislikes, which has everything in the world to do with how we set up this cycle of karma. Then I remembered a client who I'm still seeing. I see him now every few months, but for many, many years I saw him every week, who came into a treatment center when I was medical director there. And this man had this amazing story. When he was about 18 years old, when he was in college, he was hit as a pedestrian by a vehicle that was traveling 55 miles an hour. And he broke literally nearly, not every bone in his body, but close. Besides having a lot of internal bleeding, he was in the hospital for almost 2 years. He had 50-some surgeries. It was just an awful story, as you can imagine, and he lived then with chronic pain. While he was in the hospital, he also had many blood transfusions, so unbeknownst to him, he contracted hepatitis C. So it was quite the story, and one could feel very terrible for him. What happened to him, though, is that he began to take, because he was paying attention to those mu receptors, more and more and more narcotics. And then he developed anxiety, and he started to take more and more and more benzodiazepines. And after he was addicted to all of this medicine, he was then diagnosed with hepatitis C, which he had obviously gotten from these blood transfusions. So he was working with a hepatologist, and the hepatologist, liver specialist, found out that he was abusing all of these drugs, getting them from all different sources. And what great karma this man had, the liver specialist said to him, "I'm not working with you anymore." And the man has hepatitis C, and he knows that he could die. And he says, "What do you mean?" He said, "No, I don't work with people who lie to me. You're abusing all these drugs, and I'm not going to work with you." Great bit of karma, though I'm sure he didn't think it at the time. And then the wife said to him, "I'm not staying with you anymore unless you get treated." She started threatening him, "I'm leaving you." Really great karma. Now again, these are not things that would look this way in life. Nothing about this story would look like it was good karma to anybody. He comes to me, to us, to the treatment center. And I said to him, "You were really blessed that both your doctor and your wife care enough about you to behave this way with you." And I said, "And here's something else I want to tell you. You're not really in pain." This is the first time I meet the man. He, of course, thinks I've lost my mind. But I said to him, "No, you're not in pain. You're going to have to trust me because your life is on the line here, literally and figuratively. And we're going to have to get you off of all pain medicine before you can see that you're not really in pain. That the medicine itself, that the feeling of needing more and more and something other and adding to it is creating enormous pain for you. And you have no idea about that." And I don't think he believed a word I was saying, but he really had no choice. His wife was in the room, and she was saying to him basically, "You do what Dr. Rubenstein's telling you, or I'm out of here." And so the rest of the story is almost not quite as important, but I'll tell you that we got him off of all of his pain medicine, and he had no pain. Yet he had been living with severe, unrelenting pain for all of those years. Now, is this a perfect analogy to what happens to us in life? Whatever it is that we get hooked on, whatever it is, needing a little more money, needing a little more security in some way or another, needing to just fix this little detail in our life or that little detail, and the minute anything goes wrong, the market turns a little bit, we lose a little bit of money, the child makes 1B instead of straight A's, doesn't matter what it is, we panic. "Oh my God, am I going to lose all my money? Is this going to happen? Is that going to happen?" We grab on tighter to the very thing that is keeping us, what's the title of this talk, ego bondage or soul freedom. We grab on to those things the minute it starts lessening, the ego's inclination, as long as we're living in terms of the ego, what we decide to do is grab on tighter to the very things that are causing us pain and suffering. And whenever anybody tries to tell us that, it doesn't look that way. It looks as crazy as my saying to this man, you don't have any pain. You're creating your pain. We have to take away the thing that you think is treating your pain. And only then will you be able to feel better. Now, of course, we bring other things in, just like we do on the spiritual path. This man stayed in a treatment program for 3 months, and he learned a lot of tools, not the least of which was meditation, I will say to you, and taking hatha yoga classes, because that's how we ran the program, so that we were never trying to solve the problem purely at the level, the material plane level, the level at which the ego lives. Now, it's very hard to take the next step in all of this, which is to see. Helen prayed this morning before purification. I know many of you weren't here, but in her prayer, she said, feel grateful for all of the blessings that you're given. And then she went on and she explained, it's not just what we think are blessings, but anything that comes into our life is a blessing. This is what she told us when she was praying. And of course, that's the truth. But why is it the truth? Because the first thing we need to see to understand this whole notion of karma and how we create everything that's happening in our world is just that. We have to completely assume responsibility for everything that's going on. The definition of karma is that for every action, there will be an equal and opposite reaction. For every cause, there's an effect. For every thought that we've ever had, every desire, every action we've ever taken, we are creating tendencies in ourselves and a flow of energy that gets imprinted on our astral spine and just moves from life to life to life with us. It is us, and we have been creating it. What's happened to us in this life is not being done to us by some angry God. The people ask the question all the time, how am I supposed to believe in God who would do this to me? God isn't doing anything to us. God isn't angry with us. He's not out there doing some mindless play. He didn't go unconscious on us and therefore bring us things. This is all about energy. So if we can look at everything that's happening in our life, everything, even that which is so unbearably painful, and say to ourselves, what an opportunity to grow, to know without a doubt that we brought that to ourselves and for a reason, and that we in fact have the power to overcome it in certain ways, which I'm going to talk about, but not until we have said to ourselves, this is mine. Now, of course, we can't buy into any of this if we don't believe, be willing to own, get the notion of reincarnation. And I know that Asha spoke about that last week. At least it was the subject of the reading last week. But it reminded me, when I was thinking about it this morning, how impossible it is to talk about karma without understanding reincarnation. I remembered a joke that I saw once that was a letter written. It said, dear karma, can you please be a little more attentive? You've missed at least a few people that I know of. Because it doesn't always look in this life like what's happening is exactly fair. Of course, we know of so many instances where that's not the case. How could we, and we've all heard this before, how could we begin to think about children who are born with congenital anomalies, people who have their lives whisked away in a moment? How could we think about my patient who was 18 years old and in college and was hit by a car traveling 55 miles an hour, or people who are badly abused as children? Can we can't see in this life any reason for this to happen. It only makes sense if we believe in the fact that the soul, that any one life is a moment for the soul. And no matter what it is that's coming, it's coming because somewhere, sometime, just this morning, this song from A Sound of Music came to me. And of course, I remember Julie Andrews singing it in the movie, but where she says, "Somewhere in my youth or childhood days, I must have done something good. For here you are standing here loving me, whether or not you should." We're very quick to say it's good karma when the good things are coming. What about telling ourselves it's great karma when some of the difficulty comes? I wasn't being just glib when I said to myself that when that physician refused to treat that man, or his wife said, "I'm leaving," boy, was that an incredible gift to that man? It gave him the opportunity to work through this karma in this lifetime. And he's been clean and sober ever since, many years. He's a beautiful man. He's out there helping many other people. This is what happens. That's why the analogy, and to be able to see it in one life, is so fabulous. But we could never move forward if we're not willing to accept complete responsibility for what's going on in our life. We can't blame God. We can't blame anybody else. We've got to say, "This is mine." We can't move forward if we're going to try and rationally work through it. It is virtually impossible. It's like speaking two different languages. You can't try and figure it out in your mind. It doesn't even matter at this point why these things are here. All that matters is for us to constantly say to ourselves, "What tools do I need to develop? What is it that I can do that is going to carry me through? What will be my raft over this ocean of delusion?" You know, as it says in the Gita, and we hear it so often, and Swamiji said it so often, "Get thee away from my ocean of suffering." How do we do that? I was reminded of two things that Master said. You know, this saying that we have, it's not a saying, I mean a quote of Master's, "Even-minded and cheerful." It sounds so simple, doesn't it? I mean, any of us who have tried know it's not simple to live that way. But when you just say the words, "Oh, I'll be even-minded and cheerful," it's so sweet. What do they mean? What does even-minded really mean? What does cheerful mean? It doesn't mean ha-ha. It doesn't mean that kind of happy or playful. Even-mindedness means those qualities that allow us to feel centered in the divine. Even-mindedness means practicing gratitude. It means practicing humility. It means practicing generosity of the spirit. It means being forgiving. That's what helps us be even-minded. And what about cheerful? What does cheerful mean? Cheerful means right attitude. It means right action. It means holding ourselves in a position that turns us in the direction of God, right direction. You know, this beautiful poem of Master's, "God, God, God," it says, I've lost the first line. The spiral staircase, what I want to get. Who, help me. From the depths of slumber, thank you. From the depths of slumber, as I ascend, the spiral staircase of wakefulness. That's what we're talking about. That's what all of this is. How is it that we ascend? Master says, from the depths of slumber. That means living unconsciously. That means living an ego-centered life and thinking that by doing more, we will get what we want when we are actually creating more pain. What does ascending mean? Ascending a spiral staircase of wakefulness. And just think about it. A spiral staircase, what a beautiful image it is. It came to me yesterday because the way a spiral is, wherever you are, however high you go, you're always in the same position. You've just transcended more and more and more to get there. And it's always directional. It doesn't matter where we are. It doesn't matter at all. There is no point in wasting any time bemoaning our current status. All that matters is that we look in the right direction, that we take the right action, that we keep our mind in a right-minded place. That's what ascending the spiral staircase means. It doesn't mean getting there. It means waking up. It means doing just these relatively simple things. Only one question we have to ask ourselves. And this is an interesting thing. One can hardly talk about karma without talking about free will. Swamiji has told us many stories, and he says many times that there are things that were written 5,000 years ago that are true about us in this life. He shared some of them with us about readings that he had that were written several hundred years ago, where it was written several hundred years ago. He'll be born in Romania, which he was. You know, we've heard this all. In the reading, it said he'll only have brothers because his mother couldn't carry the sister. He never knew his mother had a miscarriage. But he went home to her and he asked her, "Is this true?" And she said, "Yes." And he said, "What sex was it?" And she said, "It was a girl." He never even knew. But somebody knew hundreds of years ago. People know thousands of years ago. When somebody asked Swamiji once in a satsang, how much does karma have to do with our everyday life? He said it has everything to do. He said, even down to the color of the shirt you put on this morning. Isn't that amazing? Everything is dictated by our karma. Well, then we ask ourselves, where are we? What's the point of that? That's another depressing thought. What is free will? How can we impact this? And Swami and every other master says, the only free will that we have, the only way that we can impact our karma, which means really neutralize it, which means let it be, move on from it, is to ask ourselves, is this thought, is this action, is this behavior moving me towards God or away from God? That is the extent of the free will that we have. But in that thought, in that one question that we could ask ourselves over and over, is this moving me towards God? Does this help me feel uplifted spiritually? Or does this make me feel contracted? Is it away from God? Is it selfish? Is it mean? Is it of this world? In that one question, in that one decision, lies the absolute essence of the spiritual path and how we evolve. If we can do that, if we can pause before each action, if we can start realizing that our thoughts are actions, every bit as much as any physical action is, and This is why I keep saying, right-mindedness. Keep our thoughts in a good place. Do good deeds. Then we begin to neutralize karma. We're not going to get there by kicking and screaming and yelling and fighting, by trying to plead with it, bargain with it. Master says, cosmic law works with the precision of mathematics. Even God himself can hardly intervene. But our moving towards God, our turning towards God, changes everything. It's that simple, if you will. What we need to remember is that karma is the very fiber of the fabric of our lives, and it's woven with that many threads and that kind of complexity. And that these super conscious or uplifting qualities of gratitude, of generosity, of caring, of forgiveness, of love, of being loving, are our ticket up this spiral staircase of awakening to ultimately arrive in a place filled with everything we know, our soul knows, it wants and needs to know true joy.